I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There are 8 days until Kansas decides if it wants Secretary of State Kris Kobach to be its next governor. Kobach has been criticized as the next Sam Brownback, and many prominent Republicans have endorsed his Democratic opponent, Laura Kelly. But with the gubernatorial race virtually tied, political watchers in Kansas could be in store for another long election night. After that, in our current political climate, it seems impossible someone could be a presidential advisor to both sides of the aisle. But David Gergen did just that, serving Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. Now he's a political commentator for CNN, and he joins us today. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kris Kobach is in the home stretch of a humdinger of a gubernatorial race in Kansas. Polls say the race is too close to call. As he heads down the stretch, Kris Kobach is talking about schools, illegal voting, and requiring able-bodied food stamp recipients to work. He's been on a Remain Red bus tour of Kansas, and he's just rolled into our studios just a minute ago. Kris, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Steve.
This race is too close to call. In your own words, you're running against two Democrats. Kansas is a bright red Republican state. So why is this race neck and neck?
Well, you know, as many Kansans will recognize and people in the broader listening area will remember, Kansas has had, even when the state goes, we've been going for the Republican nominee for president since 1964. But on the governor's race, we
flip
for
back
50
and
years,
forth.
We flip back and forth. There's been, for the last 50 years, no Republican has followed a Republican and no Democrat has followed a Democrat. So that means that it is to be expected that this would be a tight race.
But what's this race ultimately going to turn on, and what's going to sway voters in the end as far as you're concerned?
You know, what I think will sway voters in the end is pocketbook issues. I mean, at the end of the day, we all want to provide for our families. We all want to feel like we can make ends meet. And that's why I've been talking a lot about taxes. I mean, people in the KC Metro know that everything's cheaper on the Missouri side. Sales taxes are lower, fuel taxes are lower, income taxes are lower. And in Kansas, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice. We're hurting Kansans by, give you an example, Steve, in the Johnson County area, the average family of four is paying $1,200 a year more because of the two tax hikes we had in 2015 and 2017. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, people are going to say, well, will Kris Kobach, reduce the size of government and cut taxes? Yeah, he will. And I think that matters to people. I think the other big issue is, of course, schools. And there, my opponent, Laura Kelly, has been running ads saying falsely that I think schools are overfunded. I've never actually used that word, and I've never said that. What I have said is that school funding will continue to increase under my watch, but we will change the way the money is spent. Instead of spending 53 cents of every dollar in the classroom, we're going to spend 75 cents of every dollar in the classroom. Teachers won't be...
Governor Brownback used to say the same thing, Kris.
If he did say that, I never heard him say it, we certainly didn't achieve it because we're spending barely over 50 cents of every dollar in the classroom. And he actually didn't push for a bill to do that. I will push right out of the gate for a bill that requires us to spend that proportion of the money on classroom instruction. What would that mean in real terms? It means teacher salaries would go up. It would mean we hire more teachers. It would mean teachers wouldn't be buying classroom materials out of their own wallet. On the flip side, it would mean there would be fewer administrators. Mm-hmm. But I think most parents, I certainly think this as a parent, most parents would agree, you know what, we don't need five assistant principals. We don't need that giant administrative building with all those people who are doing things not involved in teaching my kid. So I think if we can change the way we're spending the money, we can get better results for the money we spend.
The Kansas Supreme Court, as you well know, has said that lawmakers have to again increase the amount of money they're spending on public schools. Are you prepared as governor to sign a bill that would do just that if lawmakers go along with that idea?
It depends what the Supreme Court says specifically. There's no question school funding has to grow in Kansas, but the question is, is the Supreme Court actually interpreting our Constitution? Right now, what the court seems to be doing is micromanaging every dollar spent. And I do object to the Supreme Court coming in and saying, well, we don't care what the people's representatives say they want to spend. We, the court, we unelected judges are going to tell you, no, you have to spend this much more here and that much more there, and you have to adjust for inflation.
But that's their job, though, right?
No, it is not their job.
As Supreme Court judges is to make sure that the balance of affairs is correct.
As a person who taught constitutional law for 15 years, I'll tell you categorically it is not their job. Their job is to see if a provision of the Constitution is violated. But what they have done is—
And they say one has been violated.
But what courts— Kansas is the only court in the nation where the Supreme Court has assumed the appropriations power. That is a quintessential legislative power. The court can say this law is unconstitutional, that law is unconstitutional, but they cannot then say, I order you as a judge, I order you to spend X hundred million dollars more. This appropriating of money is something that no court except the Kansas Supreme Court regards itself as having
the power. Legislature still has to actually appropriate the money.
Right. But the court is ordering them to do so. And that's way beyond the court's power. So, you know, I will be pushing to put the court back in its constitutional role, where the court certainly can adjudicate questions involving legislation, but they cannot order the appropriation of money.
Going back to my question, if the legislature attempts to abide by the Supreme Court order to spend more on schools, will you sign that bill?
Well, I'll want to ask, where's the money being spent? So if the legislature simply says, here's a blank check for X dollars, but doesn't have the 75 cents of those dollars have to be spent in the classroom, then no, I'll object to that. But if it does meet my 75 cent standard, and we do require that the money actually be spent in a way that helps kids, sure. But right now, we're not doing that.
You would be prepared to veto a spending bill that doesn't include that 75 cent provision.
Well, it depends. So we'd have to, you know, they could be two separate bills. So it could be that the 75 cents requirement would be in one bill and then this other spending. So I don't want to, you know, bind myself to a specific, but those are my objectives. We continue to spend an adequate amount on education, but we've got to start spending the money in a way that actually helps. I mean, Steve, you know this. You've been covering this issue for many years. In the past 25 years, the total amount of money we spend on education in Kansas has doubled, yet our test scores have been absolutely flat, no improvement at all. So that tells me we should start looking at where we're spending the money. If we're spending the money on lavish administrative buildings and hiring a few assistant superintendents, but we're not actually spending the money on teacher salary, on classroom materials.
But that isn't really happening, though, is it? You can point to an example or two, but there's no track record in Kansas of lavish administrative spending.
Okay, well, then I'll give you the statistic, which comes from the state of Kansas. In the last 25 years, since 1993, the total number of students in Kansas has increased 10%. The total number of teachers has increased 17%. But the total number of administrators and managers has increased 40%. So it is empirically, verifiably true that we are spending, we have increased the spending on administrators and managers far more than we've increased spending on teachers.
Well, one argument, as you well know, has been that there are too many school districts in the state of Kansas. And also one fact of life is that so many folks in western Kansas cling to those school districts because they're important to their way of life out there. Given the rise in administrators, are you prepared to cut the number of school districts throughout the state and bring that more in line with a more reasonable number?
One thing we're seeing as I travel around western Kansas is a lot of those districts are making that decision themselves because they're recognizing the economies of scale. You know, rather than having two 3A schools right next to each other, they're saying, hey, maybe we can make a better use of our collective money. What I would do from the state level is offer to have the state collectively take on certain responsibilities, like IT departments. Why should two small school districts have multiple IT departments and duplicative use of resources? Let's let the state collectively do that. Purchasing. Bring purchasing into the state level, and then you wouldn't have this redundancy in small school districts. So I think we can achieve the same economic objective, which is to avoid this wasting of money, by bringing individual things like purchasing and IT to the state level. Centralize it.
Chris Kobach, the Republican candidate for Kansas governor, is my guest. If you lose, different topic here, will that be because too many illegal votes have been cast? I mean, illegal voting has been one of your big concerns while you've been Secretary of State.
Well, we saw in the primary that it was a margin of about 343 votes or 342 right in there. If it is a close election, then illegal votes can sway the outcome. There's no question about that. You know, in Kansas, we've got photo ID now. The proof of citizenship requirement is on hold pending an appeal in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. So in theory, you could have some of that type of voter fraud occurring. One type of voter fraud that we still have a little bit of in Kansas is people voting twice. So they may, you know, reside on one side or the other of the state line, but they vote in both states. If it is close, yes, it could change the outcome. But if it would have to be a close race for it to change the outcome.
You know, federal judge Julie Robinson, you just had a case before her, and she said you failed to prove your case about voter fraud in Kansas. In fact, she said that 67 people at most had wrongly registered to vote in Kansas since 1999, while thousands of others were prevented from voting. Why are you still talking about it?
Okay, well, she didn't say you failed to prove your case. She said the standard she was using is the number of people who are non-citizens who have registered to vote, is it a substantial number? And then she said 67 was not a substantial number.
Okay.
She didn't say you failed to show that voter fraud exists or anything like that.
Well, she's suggesting as much.
Well, no, because she was only looking at one form of voter fraud. As I just mentioned, Steve, you have double voting. The court case had nothing to do with double voting. And we have prosecuted about a dozen cases in the last couple of years of double voting, more than a dozen.
Well, that would hardly suggest a rampant epidemic of double voting in the state of Kansas.
Well, actually, we had many more cases that we couldn't prosecute because the statute of limitations had run. And so you have – and then the cases – we have a small legal staff, so we just went after the cases that were the
easiest. How many more are you talking about?
How are you talking about?
How many more double voting cases?
Well, I think in a typical year, you're going to have – typical election cycle, before we started going after this and prosecuting it, you'd have somewhere between – I would say between 10 and 80, you know, some less than 100 typically in Kansas, but not just one or two. You would have, you know, double digit numbers, and it would fluctuate from year to year. Now that we're actually prosecuting it, I'm hoping that double voting will go down. We have seen that it appeared to go down in 2016, and that hopefully is because people say, you know what, they take voter fraud seriously in Kansas and they prosecute it.
You know, at Kansas, as Kansas Secretary of State, your job is to administer elections. During the primary, there were some issues with counting up results in Johnson County. And at the time, you know, you asked your deputy, Eric Rucker, to oversee the process in your stead. Some are calling for you to do the same during the midterms to recuse yourself because you're on the ballot for governor. Will you do that?
So every state that has an elected Secretary of State, which includes both Kansas and Missouri, and includes the majority of states, has a situation every other election cycle where the Secretary of State himself or herself is on the ballot. And so if you held a standard that, well, the Secretary of State cannot be involved in overseeing the election in which he or she is on the ballot, then you would have Secretaries of State all across America having to give up their constitutional duties and not do what they are supposed to do under the Constitution every other election. So what I have said, no, at this point, I will not, you know, forego my constitutional duties. But what I have said is if we get to a really close race on election night, and if it is all down to the counting of provisional ballots, then I will recuse myself at that point so that I will not oversee the counting of those provisional ballots, which is what I did in the primary as well. I recused myself and said, hey, this is a really close one. I will step out now and nobody, you know, because at that point, it's a county by county process. And I think it's appropriate for the Secretary of State to step out when it's so close like that.
Secretary of State Chris Kobach is my guest. You just compared your chief rival, Democrat Laura Kelly, to Bernie Sanders. Why?
Well, because her views on a host of issues are right next to Bernie Sanders. Kansas right now is the third highest state in America in the number of state and local government employees per capita, and she wants to expand government spending in Kansas. She's on virtually every issue. She's for gun control. She's pro-choice. She doesn't seem to be offended in any way or have any problem with the fact that our taxes in Kansas are the highest in the five-state area. And so she has taken a big government approach, and anyone who's looking for tax relief under her administration is going to be disappointed. So here we are in Kansas with bloated government, and her answer is, let's have more government.
You know, you've said that you won't raise taxes, Chris. In fact, you said that you will cut them and you will cut state services first. What will you cut? Can you give voters a sense of where you're going?
Well, I didn't say I would cut state services first. What I said is I would cut the size of state agencies. So we have an incredible opportunity right now in America, and that is that the baby boomers are retiring at a rate of 11,000 people a day nationally. So when I came in as Secretary of State, I wanted to at least hold our budget flat. And I said to my deputies, we'll hold it flat. Let's see if we can make some cuts. And one thing we found is that people were retiring just naturally. We didn't have to fire people. But by natural, through natural attrition, we were then able to say, well, do we have to replace every person? And the answer is no. So we, in about two-thirds of the vacancies, we replaced them. But in about one-third of the vacancies, we left it open. And so my agency shrunk by 18%, and our total spending shrunk by 34%.
So where's the tipping point, though, if you cut employees or employees retire? Where's the tipping point to make sure that state government can operate efficiently and effectively?
So in each agency, it's different. We found in the Secretary of State's office, there were some employees we absolutely had to replace. But there were other areas where maybe because more things were being done online, we had an excess of state employees. And so in each agency, as governor, I'll be saying to the secretary, look, I want you to use this natural attrition that's happening in America demographically right now. Use that to try to shrink your agency. I'm not going to force you to just shrink across the board, but you will find, as I did as Secretary of State, that there are some areas where you probably have too many employees, and I'm going to give each secretary a target. Let's shrink by X number of employees, X percentage if you can in the first year, and I think we'll realize savings. And then when we realize those savings, we can pass them along to taxpayers.
You know, you don't buy this notion that prisons are underfunded, that the state highway program doesn't have the money it needs, that children's services are underfunded. What about those needs in the state that have been identified by both Republicans and Democrats as areas that need more funding?
So the highways is one area where I do believe we need more funding. And of course, education has to continually climb at a moderate pace. And we have to, as I've said earlier, transfer where the money is being spent more into the classroom.
To be clear, Brownback and Collier have taken more than $2.5 billion in payments from the state road fund to prop up the state general fund.
And that is something I object to and will not continue under my administration. So the reason I want to shrink the number of employees in so many state agencies is so we can stop robbing the bank of Kansas Department of Transportation. You're right. We have been sweeping money out of the highways funds to fund bloated agencies elsewhere in government.
But you can't reduce spending and stop taking money out of the state highway fund, Chris, without making dramatic cuts in spending across the board. Employee attrition won't make up for that.
It will. Look, through employee attrition, we cut my budget 34% in 7 years. That's a third. Cut government by a third in 7 years. If we can do something comparable statewide, there will be a significant savings, and we can then stop sweeping the money from the highway fund. We can get our roads built, and we can get our roads maintained. And we can also hopefully pass along those savings, some savings to taxpayers as well. And here's one thing, Steve, too. One of the things I've been talking about in taxpayer relief is our property taxes, our appraisal increases. Now, this won't cost the state a dime, but it's something we have to do. We have to have a 2% cap on appraisal hikes. People in Johnson County in particular have seen this. Your appraised value of your house goes up 15% 1 year, then it goes up 8%, then it goes up 20%.
Critics say you'll cripple local government if you do that.
No, it won't cripple local government at all. It'll force local government to be accountable. If they want to raise your taxes, they're going to have to take a vote and take responsibility. They can't just send the appraiser out to do the tax hike for them. And that's essentially what's happening in so many parts of our state. The appraised values of properties are going up unjustifiably quick in order to extract revenue from taxpayers.
You're saying 2% no matter what?
Yeah, 2% per year, no matter what. And the other thing I think we need to do in
but
Kansas—
what if the city has an unexpected expense, a major road, a need that props up that would go beyond that?
Then the city can raise the mill levy and go to the voters and ask for that. So it doesn't—
There's still
a way for the city to raise that revenue, but at least they have to get the approval of taxpayers to do it through an increase in the mill levy.
You know, critics say that a Kobach administration would be like a third term of a Sam Brownback administration. Democrats are running ads. Laura Kelly every day talking about that. How would you be different, really?
So my response to those ads is to say, let's look at some of the biggest issues in this campaign. Sales taxes. Sam Brownback signed the 2015 sales tax hike. Laura Kelly wanted an even bigger hike in sales taxes. I'm opposed to that hike, and I would have vetoed it, and I want to cut our sales taxes. So Laura Kelly stands with Sam Brownback. Government spending. Spending went through the roof under Brownback. Laura Kelly wants more of it. I'm saying we need to cut government spending. So Laura Kelly stands with Sam Brownback. Illegal immigration. Sam Brownback had no appetite to do anything about the illegal immigration issues. Neither does Laura Kelly. I'm different. So listen, on those three major areas, I am on the opposite side of Sam Brownback and Laura Kelly. So I would say, will the real Sam Brownback please stand up? Laura Kelly is the one who's going to continue his policies,
but
not me.
But the criticism of Governor Brownback was he crippled the state going forward, that the state's sort of traditional moderate way of governing, whether it's, you know, prisons, schools, social services, were all rendered largely ineffective because of what he's done. Look what's happening in the prisons. Look what's happening with Child Protective Services. All kinds of issues
in the wake of Brownback's administration. I think you need to be more specific. So the main specific criticism was that he cut taxes and then we had this budget crisis. That was a problem, but not because of the tax cut. It's the problem that he didn't combine a tax cut with reductions in spending. And so
he didn't let the employees go that you're talking
right,
about.
Right. He didn't do this natural attrition. And so I agree that you can't cut taxes if you're going to have spending continue to climb. And that's what he did. And I think that was a mistake. With respect to specific agencies like the Department of Children and Families, I agree. The Brownback administration was in charge when we saw the loss of 70 plus kids. Now, the loss technically, you know, when you're talking specifics, most of these kids were foster homes and they ran away.
These are kids that we couldn't locate at
any
one time.
After they ran away. Yeah. And I think there were some clear problems of management, the way the system works. What I want to do is one of the problems we have with DCF, as I've investigated it, is many of these kids, they would just be passed from one administrator to another administrator, and they would never feel like there was one person at the state they could call if they had a problem. There was no person who they felt like was looking out for them. So what I would change is every person in the foster program is going to have one person in the state they can always call. They'll have his cell phone number or her cell phone number. And whenever there's a problem in any foster home, wherever, they can always call that person who's always looking out for them. I think that change in and of itself would do a lot to solve many of the problems within the DCF system.
What about state prisons, what we fund, what we pay for guards? A lot of folks say they don't get paid enough. We're seeing unrest in prisons. Does that need to change? What do you do there?
Yeah, there are a number of reforms we need to make in our prisons. We absolutely have to pay guards a competitive salary that rewards them for their time and their efforts for the state. It is not an easy job at all. The other thing I want to do with respect to our prison system is we should be doing more of prison work programs in our lower security prisons. There are so many parts of Kansas where employers are demanding labor. We've got a prison population in a lower or minimum security prison that would like to be earning some money and would like to get outside of the prison walls. And in places where we've tried it, it's really working well. The employer gets badly needed labor. The prisoner gets the opportunity to learn another job skill, make some money, and hand it to his family on the outside. And the state is better off because we now have a prisoner who's helping to pay for his room and board.
Yeah, you were critical just a minute ago of Governor Brownback. And what I'm wondering is, was he a successful governor in your view?
You know, to answer that question, you have to say in what respect. So in terms of pro-life—
Just overall, what's your sense, your gut sense of his administration?
Well, think of it as a student who's got lots of grades. In keeping our state pro-life and in actually signing pro-life legislation, he gets an A+, for sure. In balancing the budget— not so much. I mean, it'd probably be a C or a D. I mean, at the end of the day, he came to an agreement with the legislature, but he didn't cut spending. But let me rephrase it. In cutting spending, I would say a C or a D. You go down the list of issues. In reforming government, you know, a B. He did make some significant changes in the way agencies are structured, but I think we could have done more. So it's hard to say what the grade is overall.
Ultimately, do you pass him or not? You used to be a professor.
Yeah, I think he passes, but not with an A.
President Trump, does the president's anti-immigrant rhetoric lead to violence like that we saw in Pennsylvania this weekend, Chris? What about the explosive devices that we're now seeing the man accused of sending to Democratic backers and party leaders? What about the president's role in that?
I don't see how the president's speaking about illegal immigration has anything to do with what happened in Pennsylvania. And in terms of what happened in Pennsylvania, look, the president has been a friend of Israel. The president he's the one who actually made the move that America has been saying it's want to make for decades and actually, you know, moved our embassy to Jerusalem. His daughter and son-in-law are Jewish. I don't think anyone can fairly accuse the president of, through his rhetoric, somehow motivating a crazed madman to do what he did there. With regard to the packages that were sent to various Democrats, I mean, I think you've got it's very similar to the
But should he liberal condemn attack? White nationalists, Chris? I mean,
well, let me continue on this. Remember when Steve Scalise was shot and very nearly killed, and you had a very liberal attacker who attacked the Republican congressional baseball team. I don't think Barack Obama and Democrats were responsible for inciting that madman to do what he did. I think we try to draw some conclusions that really can't be drawn if we say, aha, this particular statement by a national leader caused this madman to take up arms or to do something drastic. So I just don't think you can draw that link.
I got 30 seconds left. You know, you're a controversial guy. How will you go about appealing to all Kansans, even those who vote for somebody else next Tuesday, if you're ultimately elected governor here?
My point is this. One thing, if you look at my record and you say, well, okay, what did Kris Kobach say he would do in 2010 when he became Secretary of State? Proof of citizenship, photo ID, prosecuting election fraud. He did everything he said he would do.
Donald Trump says the same thing. I'm wondering, how do you bring Kansans who disagree with you and help them feel for you and allow you to work with them?
My point is that if a person listens to what I'm saying and says, you know, I agree with Kobach on two out of three things, well, at least with me, you know I'm going to get done those two out of three things. If you listen to a politician who just tries to make everybody feel good and talks in fluffy terms that are not specific, you have no idea what you're going to get. But in my case, we're going to try to put more money in the classroom. We're going to work really hard to make our taxes lower in Kansas so that on our side of the state line, we're not seeing ourselves squeezed, unlike what's happening on Missouri's side. So I will follow through on my promises.
That's Kris Kobach. He's running for governor of Kansas as a Republican. Kris, always good to have you here. Travel safe out there. You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with former presidential advisor David Gergen about what it would be like to advise this current president. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, take a break from the stress and anxiety of our world to hear about hope and staying optimistic from best-selling author Anne Lamott. New York Times, again, she'll be joining us tomorrow on the show and offer you some balm for your soul. When David Gergen talks, presidents listen. Gergen has advised four presidents of both parties, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. These days, Gergen has a lot to say about the current occupant of the White House. In the wake of last week's reports about the servicing of pipe bombs intended for prominent news outlets and Democratic politicians, David Gergen let loose, saying the president had unleashed the dogs of hatred in this country and had refused to take an ounce of responsibility for his own rhetoric. David Gergen is a senior political analyst at CNN and director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard. He'll be in town in a couple of weeks speaking to Village Shalom's Ages of Excellence dinner, and he joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In the wake of last week's pipe bombs mailed to prominent Democrats, you say President Trump has unleashed the dogs of hatred in America and has refused to take responsibility for his own rhetoric. In fact, as you know, he blamed the news media for it. How far out of the norm is this president's rhetoric, and how much does it concern you?
Well, I think most Americans can make that decision for themselves, but I'm deeply concerned. Listen, I don't think we should hold the president directly responsible for what happened in Pittsburgh or in Kentucky or indeed for these pipe bombs over the past week. I don't think, you know, that he said to somebody, go do this, and they did it. What I do think their president is responsible for, as every one of his predecessors has borne this responsibility, is to set the tone, the moral tone of the country. And on that issue, I am deeply concerned about where he's been and where he's going. You know, it's been true throughout our history that there is hatred and violence. We're not immune from violence as a people. If anything, as many of us Anglo-Saxon, we probably are more violent than a lot of people around the world. But that violence has always simmered below the surface. And the role of a president has been to cool it down, to make sure it does not erupt, so that we can live together peacefully, that we can see ourselves as fellow citizens, that we believe in the motto of the country, e pluribus unum, from many one, that we're all in this together. That's what I mean by cooling it down and encouraging people to resolve disputes peacefully and with a sense of cooperation and compassion and empathy. Much of what we've seen in Pittsburgh is people have responded to these horrific shootings in the synagogue. dialogue. And instead of that, I'm afraid to say, and I say this reluctantly, but I do believe it's true, that this president has chosen to put those resentments and racial anxieties and hatreds, to put them on boil. So that it's almost inevitably action is going to result. When you have rallies that seem to encourage people to fight, he talks about it, body slamming a reporter. There are other times, lock her up, these chants that he seems to enjoy about Hillary, or it could be about George Soros, a Jew. That there has been a lot of spewing of discrimination against George Soros. So I think it's the responsibility of the president not to put the things on boil, but to help him simmer them down. And I don't believe that's happened. And I do believe he ought to take some accountability for this. I frankly don't think that's going to happen before the midterms.
I was going to say, why do you think he won't take responsibility?
I think it's time for a course correction.
Why do you think he won't take responsibility for his role in stirring up hatred and in, you know, occasionally acknowledging he may have taken a misstep?
Well, I think in the first place he doesn't believe that. He doesn't believe he's at fault. He never does, frankly. And I don't know what that comes from. There's a compulsion on his part whenever something goes wrong to blame somebody else. And I often think, is he in denial, or are people just not talking to him in his staff? You know, I think he does, in his heart of hearts, mean well for the country. And I think if you look at some of his policies, and especially in the economic realm, you have to say he's contributed positive things to the economic growth, and to this, to say the unemployment rate of African Americans is better today than it has been. So there are some things he's done well, but I think in terms of setting this moral tone, and encouraging us to think, you know, to call upon the better angels in our nature, as Lincoln called them, it's just not in him. Now the test, we'll see, that we keep looking for turning points, and maybe after these midterms, all of us can calm down and begin to figure out how we're going to live together with each other. It's just unimaginable to me. I don't know how you feel about this, but it's unimaginable to me that we can go on like this for two more years,
yeah,
especially for six more years.
David Gergen is my guest. He's advised four presidents of both parties, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's a senior political analyst at CNN. David, I'm wondering, you know, given the fact you've advised these different presidents of different parties, could you see yourself working for this president?
I don't think so. I first of all, most importantly, I cannot. It's unimaginable, totally unimaginable that he would ask me. So it's not a question I've had to think about very much. But no, I don't think so. Here's what I also think. I think it's very difficult for any of the people around him to advise him and expect him to change. I just don't see that happening. The General Kelly has tried. Others around him have tried, and they have had no noticeable impact on how he behaves. And he thinks it's a winning strategy. What I do think is, if the people that he will listen to are not the advisors, the people he will listen to are the voters. I think that he has been surrounded in these rallies by people who are totally enthusiastic for him, come out, cheer, and treat him, you know, almost as a demigod. And naturally enough, he feels like the whole country is with him. Whereas, in fact, what he's doing, going into his own strongholds, rallying the troops, and he's very effective at that. You have to say he's very effective. But I don't think that speaks for the country.
You know, one question I'm sure you get a lot is, does this president listen to his advisors? I mean, how many people have urged him to stop tweeting, and he continues to tweet? Do you think anyone has his ears? Is anyone listening to him? Is he listening to anybody?
Well, I think one has to distinguish. I think that on the behavioral stuff, the narcissism, the strongman, the affinity for strongmen, all of that stuff, you know, the authoritarian impulses, I don't think he listens to people, perhaps to Ivanka occasionally, less so for Jared. But where I do think he listens to people more is on policy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he is clearly listening to his new national security advisor, John Bolton. He's doing a number of things. He's pulling out of various international agreements, which John Bolton has been advocating for years. And, you know, Bolton seems to have his ear on foreign policy. Steve Miller has his ear on on immigration policy, very hardline immigration policy, going after these caravans, you know, that are sort of ragtag groups coming north. And so, you know, there are in some areas, I do think he listens, but on his behavior, his general approach to setting a tone, I think he's going to be listening to the voters. And if the voters speak loudly in this midterm and say, you're off course, you know, and say and they lose a lot of seats in the House of Representatives, I think that's the one thing that would send him in a different direction. If, on the other hand, Republicans retain the House, and I think they're going to retain the Senate and probably increase their numbers there, he's going to be emboldened. Hmm. He's going to think he has a fresh mandate, a nationwide mandate. You know, people always disputed whether he really won the election in 2016 because he got so many fewer votes than Hillary did. But this would be this is clearly a referendum on him. And if his party wins, and I think their chances are better than most people think they are, to win the House, he's going. I can just guarantee you he's going to feel emboldened, and he will act more strongly and with more vigor and with more passion and with more of a sense of power than he has even in these first 2 years.
David Gergen will be the featured speaker at Village Shalom's Ages of Excellence benefit on Wednesday, November 14th at the Intercontinental on the Plaza. More information at villageshalom.org. David, what's the key to offering good advice to the President of the United States?
Well, the key to working with any boss, whether it's the president or, you know, the CEO of your company or indeed the chief cleric in your church or your synagogue. I think the most important thing is to listen and to begin to see the world through that other person's eyes so that you empathically can understand how they understand the world. And then you can begin to sort of decide what adjustments you would want to suggest. I do think there is such a thing as speaking truth to power. It takes courage to do that, but it's necessary. I think it's even more important to speak conscience to power. And in these days, especially with these horrific events of the past weeks, and there's nothing that's been more heartbreaking than what happened in Pittsburgh. I do hope that people around him will speak conscience to power. I think that he may not listen, but it's really important to speak up.
Yeah, how did the different presidents you worked for over the years react to the advice, you know, you gave them? I mean, how open were they to hearing what you had to say?
Well, I think probably they didn't listen with as much as energy and acceptance as I hope they might. I had the good fortune, the privilege of working for several presidents who were very receptive to serious conversation. I frankly was so young that I never felt I had much impact on Richard Nixon, but I learned a lot from him. And, you know, we went down the ship when he went down. I thought I had no future in American public life. And frankly, this is a very forgiving country. but in any event, I thought I had more influence in the Ford administration and in the Reagan administrations. I was in a more, you know, I was a, I'd moved up from being an ensign to a lieutenant, or moved a little higher up in the ranks, and people naturally listened a little more. But I was fortunate enough to, Jerry Ford was a wonderful man, and I just always felt he listened. Ronald Reagan was selective in what he listened to, but I thought his instincts were extraordinarily good, and I frankly thought he was the best leader we've had in the White House since Franklin Roosevelt, at the time he served. Probably the president who listened the most closely was Bill Clinton. He brought me in when he was his early days of his presidency, when he was the transition from a landlocked state like Arkansas to Washington. It's a difficult transition.
Right.
And, you know, he was having a hard time getting hold of it and asked me, so we'd known each other a long time, and I'd known Hillary as well. And he trusted me, and he brought me in and when he was slipping and sliding. And, you know, the answer was, what I learned from other presidents was, you can't change the president's spots. What you need to do is help them remember their strengths. Mm-hmm. And with Bill Clinton, what I tried to do was help him remember who he was at his best, what kind of values he represented, how he lost a lot of his self-confidence. And we tried to create a safe space for him to regain confidence in himself. And he worked his way out of his hole and went on to be, I think, a very effective president on most fronts, despite the Monica Lewinsky saga. I think it was one of the last times in this country that the people at the bottom moved up more rapidly than people at the top. And there was a real sense, and that was actually true. There was more income gain as a percentage in the lower ranks than it was at the top. And that was very healthy for the country. We need to get back to closing this terrible inequality gap, which is one of the reasons, one of several reasons why we're so much at each other's throats. We have to deal with that. And frankly, we have to deal with racism and tribalism in the country. We're dividing up too much into people who are identified as white or black or woman or man. And we've got to get back to the notion that these distinctions are less important than the fact we all belong to the same society, the same family.
You know, each of these presidents, it seems to me, played politics, by the old rules, Reagan and
yes.
Ford and right. Clinton and Carter. To what extent has this current president changed American politics forever, or is he simply just an outlier?
That's a really good question. I don't think we know the answer yet. I think a great deal. If somebody is going to run against him, that is like the opposite of who he is, and be much more of a traditionalist. Whether that person can still win, whether that kind of opponent can still win in this country, I don't know. You have to worry about. It's not the breaking of laws, although we'll wait and see what Mueller has to say. It is the breaking of the unwritten laws, of good governance, and the fact that we hold our presidents and have held them to a standard of truth in the past. We've actually expected them not to tell us lies, and now we're up to I don't know how many thousands now that have been counted by the Washington Post,
right.
Lies or misstatements. I mean, it's just extraordinary, and so. What my hope is that we'll never permit that again. I mean, it has become normalized, I'm afraid, right now. But you can't guarantee that. Listen, there, a country after country is moving in a more authoritarian direction. Just look what happened over the weekend in Brazil. A far right candidate has now been elected president of Brazil. They call him the Trump of Latin America.
Right.
In Germany over the weekend, we had votes in Hesse and Bavaria that have weakened Angela Merkel. She's now said she's going to be stepping down in the next 2 or 3 years. And she was the glue holding Western Europe together. As a really responsible leader. So you have to worry about the rise of authoritarianism, the rise of strongmen in various countries, including the United States. And we're not immune to this. So I think it's really important, as I say, voting is the way to stand up and be heard. If you endorse this, vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like the direction we're going, then it's really important to vote.
Former presidential advisor David Gergen is my guest. A lot of Americans say this president makes them nervous every day. I'm wondering, does he make you nervous?
Yes. I find these very stressful times. I don't know whether, and I don't think we can put all this blame on him. I do think we end up, who are fortunate enough to have access to the airwaves, can talk and that sort of thing, as we're doing here. It's a privilege to do that. I do think we need to be careful about the facts, make sure we get our facts right. Helen Thomas, who was a famous UPI
right.
correspondent, you'll remember. Her slogan was, get it first, but first get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do that. We need to avoid being too prejudiced. I think we've got to seek fairness in the way we cover President Trump. I think he deserves that. Every American president deserves that. If it would do any good, I would encourage, after the elections are over, if anybody can figure out whether this would do some good, I would love to see the president sit down with, as I've seen other presidents do, I've been part of it, you know, we'd invite in the publishers of the major newspapers. We would invite in the heads of the news divisions of the networks and the cable folks, and talk about how we can restore more civility to our public life.
Mm-hmm.
And figure out, you know, let each side have a go at it privately in some private meeting, and see if they can, we can begin to rebuild right. some foundations of civility. I just think we can't go on like this.
David, we've been talking about the Republicans and President Trump during your visit here. Let's flip it. Do the Democrats have a message and an agenda that's ready to roll with the American people right now?
I'm really glad you asked that question. The short answer is no. Or at least it hasn't come across in this campaign. The Democrats have for the most part been identified as being, their fundamental agenda is anti-Trump. You know, to do anything you can to stop him. There has been discussion, to be fair to the Democrats, about saving health elements of the health care, Obamacare, especially protection from pre-existing conditions.
Right.
Democrats have also been arguing that we need to get drug prices under control. They're just exorbitant, and they're rising much faster than they should. So they do have some issues, but I think it has not been a clearly communicated nationalization of the race. They've nationalized the Trump part, but they haven't nationalized the policy agenda. I think it's really, really hard to tell if the Democrats took back the House what they're going to do in the next 2 years. I don't know whether they're going to be consider themselves and come out of these elections as a much farther to the left than they have been,
mm-hmm.
or whether they're going to come out and say the races we actually did pretty well in, surprisingly well in, are the ones from the center left. For example, I'm very I'm a big supporter of young veterans running for Congress this year, mm-hmm. as well as young women running for Congress. I think both are going to bring a lot of change to our politics over time. And the veterans that I see are mostly doing well because they're going from the center left. They're running as pragmatic, right. not ideological candidates.
David,
I think Americans mostly favor that.
I got like 30 seconds. Who are the Democrats?
Sure.
Who's the best prospect they got to run for the White House in 2020? Do you see somebody out there who can give Trump a run?
I don't yet. I think we have to be fair and let the system play out a little mm-hmm. bit. Who would have ever thought Beto O'Rourke might be an interesting candidate?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
A year ago, and he's come out of nowhere. And often that happens. Donald Trump came out of nowhere, so give it a little time. But I do think that from my point of view, they're going to be far better off as Democrats electing someone who's a moderate than electing someone way over to the left. I think Donald Trump will take that person to down pretty easily.
Again, David Gergen will be the featured speaker at Village Shalom's Ages of Excellence benefit on Wednesday, November 14th. More information, villageshalom.org. David, you're always a great guest. Thanks for taking some time.
Okay, thank you so much.
It's
a privilege to talk to you.
You bet.
Bye.
All the bye. Tomorrow, the 2016 election shocked the nation, but this pollster actually predicted it right. Tomorrow, Neil Newhouse's thoughts on the next election and the future of polling in politics. Also on the show, New York Times bestselling author Anne Lamott. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.